hear them, okay. Okay, colleagues, can you quickly get your keys? I'm calling for your attention. Latecomers, you want to delay as well. Okay, we are going to start with the comments with our meeting. And let me welcome the competition tribunal through the leadership of Mr. Manuel. You welcome this afternoon to our meeting. We are going to be considering your annual report. Yes, we will, without a waste of time, after welcoming you. And oh, let me welcome back the members to the meeting. May we request that you, without a waste of time, make the presentation on your annual report, sir?
Chair, thanks very much. We appreciate the chair and the members giving us the opportunity to present our report for 2009-2010. May I just introduce who are here today? I'm Norman Nenoyam. I'm the chairperson of the tribunal. With me on my right is Lerato Motohong, who is the registrar of the tribunal. And on my left is Janine de Klerk, who is head of the corporate services, which includes the finances. We then just go on to what we do, and this is slightly repetitive of what you might have heard from us before, but if we can just go on to the next slide. Right, we are, just to distinguish us from the commission who you heard from this morning, we are the court of the system. They are the policeman and the prosecutor. We are the court, and we are an independent body, and our job is essentially just two things. We deal with merger regulation, we adjudicate mergers, and we deal with what are called prohibitive practices, which are things like cartels and abuse of dominance, and we hear those cases. So we are the court of the system. In merger regulation, what we do is we can have a merger before us, and we can either do one of three things. We can either authorize the merger, we can prohibit the merger, or we can allow the merger but make it implemented subject to conditions. And we'll give you a few examples of what that is later when we discuss some of the cases we did in the course of this year. In restrictive practices, we do adjudicate the complaint referrals brought by the Commission or by private parties. We may also adjudicate what are called interim relief applications. Those are cases which are brought as a matter of urgency for relief in somebody's actually brought a complaint. So assume that someone has brought a complaint to the Commission, that the case takes some time to resolve and they need an urgent relief. They can approach us themselves. The Commission doesn't do it, but the complainant of the case, and we can give an order which is valid for a period of 6 months, but is subject to renewal. Thirdly, we adjudicate appeals from the Competition Commission's decisions regarding exemptions. In fact, in 11 years, we've never had to do that sort of thing because our system doesn't have many exemptions, and so disputes around exemptions which are granted by the Commission seldom arise. I can then go on to, Lerato will take us to the highlights of the cases.
Thank you, Chair. Just to give you a highlight on what we've done on cases this year, we had 85 cases. That would be all all our cases, measures and prohibited practices, and we issued 71 reasons. We issued reasons in cases where we've made decisions. And 63.4 of our hearings in measures took place within 10 days of receipt of the case as per our tribunal rules. And we've made decisions in measures within the 10 days of hearing. And we spent 75 days in hearings this year, and we had 369 media reports in newspapers and in online media. Just to give you a breakdown on the cases that we had and the types, we had 52 measures, and then we issued reasons in 60 of them. The balance would have been measures that we had in the previous year, and the reasons were only issued in this financial period. And we've had 23 procedural matters, and we issued reasons in 7 of them. We would have only issued 7, and that would have been on cases where the parties actually asked for reasons. Otherwise, we just make the decision, and then the parties would be happy with that. We didn't have any intermediate major activities. In terms of restrictive practices, we had 5 consent orders, and we didn't have to decide on any of them. So we didn't have to issue reasons on any of them, but we did make decisions. And we had 2 opposed referrals, and we issued reasons in both of them. And then we had 2 further complaints from a complainant. That would have been a matter that the commission non-referred, and the parties would have brought their case directly to us, and we issued reasons in 2 of the cases. And we had 1 interim relief application, and I think we only made a decision only in this financial year. Just to give you an idea on how our trends have been on measures, I'll just look at 2008, 2009, 2009, 2010. You see that in 2008, 2009, we had just over 100 measures that we had and decided on. And in this financial year, we only had probably about half of that, that's only 52. And the reason for that is we don't have reasons for that because we don't really have control over that. But it could have been because of the changes in the threshold, as well as just the economic crisis that we found ourselves in. And if we look at our major trends over the 10 years, we decided on 712, and about 90% of that were approved unconditionally. And we had 8.4 of those approved subject to certain conditions. And we've only prohibited 1.1 measures that have come before us. And the trends in this period, we had 52, we decided on 52, sorry, and 92.3 were approved unconditionally, and 7.7 were approved subject to conditions. And on the next slide, Norman will just give more information on those that are subject to conditions.
One of the things that we mentioned before is that unusual to the South African merger system is that you don't simply consider a merger from purely the competition grounds. Will the merger lead to a lessening of competition? We're also allowed to consider certain public interest issues that the merger may have an effect on, and they are specifically mentioned in the Act, but one of those in particular is the effect on employment, and that is the one that usually figures largely when we consider the public interest. Now, when a merger comes about, particularly if it's between competitors, it can lead to redundancy because people who previously had two head offices may decide to have 1 head office and they start to retrench staff. So staff are vulnerable from the point of view of their employment as a result of a merger, and we are asked to look at under the Act to consider what is called a substantial public interest effect, and one of those effects can be employment. Now, in several mergers this year, and we named those cases there, there were substantial effects on public interest that we felt necessary to place conditions on the merger to, as it were, ameliorate the job losses. In some cases, for instance, the Harmony Gold Pomodzi merger was a takeover by Harmony of a mine at Pomodzi in the Free State, which was a mine in serious economic trouble. And what had happened was that the union and the new owner, Harmony, had agreed employment terms to be negotiated between the NUM, one of the other unions, and Harmony. And what we did was to make compliance with that agreement part of the condition of approval of the merger, which strengthened legally the hand of the employees if there was a breach, because the employer would not only be in breach of a contract with the unions, but would also be breach of the conditions of the merger, which would have consequences including either a fine for the firm if the breach was material, or even unscrambling of the merger. So because there was a substantial job loss, we imposed a condition. But the condition we imposed was simply compliance with the agreement that the employees had reached with the employer. In other words, we didn't second-guess their bargain. We were advised it was a fair negotiation process, all the parties supported it, but we strengthened the employees' hand in that. Similarly, that was the case between Nedbank and Imperial Bank. In the case of BidPaper and Pretoria Wholesalers, there hadn't been a substantial negotiation, as the case was with Speco and Sherline. And in fact, in the latter one, with Speco and Sherline, there'd been a bypassing of the union, no negotiation, but a likelihood of job losses. In the case of Speco and Sherline, we said there could be no merger-related retrenchments over a period of 2 years because they failed to reach an agreement with the unions and there was likely to be substantial job losses, because the Act makes it fairly clear that employers must bargain with the unions over job losses, and if there are job losses, they must consult and try and resolve the issues. And our view is that where no negotiation has taken place, that employers, in a sense, must bear the consequences of that. There will be some restriction on merger-related retrenchments. Then you distinguish merger-related retrenchments from operational retrenchments. What we're interested in is, but for the merger, would there have been job losses? How do we apply that? Well, in general terms, we have said, if there's been a negotiation between labor and employers and they've reached an agreement, we will respect that and not interfere with that. If there hasn't been negotiation, there's a substantial job loss, we would look into, is there justification for that job loss? Now, there may be reasonable justification. For instance, the target firm is in financial trouble, and so there have to be job losses because the firm needs to be saved. Alternatively, it could be linked to the competitiveness of the firm. In other words, the merged firm would not be competitive but for the necessity of job losses, and by making it more efficient, it is able to lower its costs and make it more competitive in the economy. So that would be a justification, perhaps, for job losses. If retrenchments are substantial, they are merger-specific, there hasn't been a negotiation with trade unions, and there isn't justification, it is likely that we would put a condition temporarily onto that merger to protect employment. If I could give an example that is hot off the press from this morning, it's not related to the annual report period, but this is an example. There's been a merger which we approved this morning between two big insurance companies, Metropolitan and Momentum. The firm said there would be a job loss of 1,000 and wanted, as it were, to be able to retrench as a result of the merger up to 1,000 people. We had a hearing. The trade union was involved in the hearing. We felt that the job loss was not justified. We put a condition out saying that they may not retrench anybody as a result of the merger other than senior management people for a period of 2 years since the date of approval, which is today. Just an example of that. Then if I can move on to another slide where we talk about other conditions. Sorry, I haven't done the other one. We also can place competition conditions on competition issues. This merger, Chlor-Alkali and Botash, involved two firms that mine chemical salt, and it would lead to the merger had gone ahead, it would lead to a monopoly, in other words, a single firm supplying this chemical salt to companies in South Africa. What had happened was that there was a condition agreed between one of the customers, which was Sasol, and the merging parties in relation to the supply to Sasol only. And we broadened that condition and said it must apply to any other. In other words, the conditions which related to pricing over the next few years should be applied to any other competitor of Sasol if they enter the market. At the moment, Sasol is its only company, a customer for this chemical salt. The reason for the condition was if another company wants to enter and compete with Sasol in producing this chemical salt, it should be given the same advantages from the contract as these companies provided buys in the same volumes. And that's what the condition addresses. However, there's sometimes where, in a sense, emerging firms get an advantage out of us. And during the year, we did a case involving the Mass Cash Group. That's the group who own Mass Market, and there's talk in the market that they might be a target for Walmart. They bought a wholesale firm in Port Elizabeth. The commission recommended that the merger be prohibited, and the commission, to its credit, had done quite a fancy bit of economic modelling to show that the MassCash subsidiary in Port Elizabeth and Finro were closest competitors, and had gone to a great deal of work in doing this, and said that these two would lessen competition if they were merged. We had quite a long hearing with a lot of technical analysis of it, and unfortunately there were some problems with the technically with the Commission's evidence, and we felt the case for prohibition wasn't good enough, so we overturned the Commission's conditions, although we complimented on the effort that they had made to try and do that. Go on to
In terms of the turnaround times for measures, our rules make it very clear that we need to deal with measures as soon as we receive them. So what has happened in this year is that 33 of the 52 measures that we had them within the 10 days of the Commission's referral. The majority of the other matters that we were not able to hear within the 10 days we were out by a day or two, and the balance would have been measures that we received over like the Easter period and the December period, and that's where we need to negotiate with the parties, and then we try and hear them as soon as they are available or when we are available, but we really have to negotiate with them on the day, so we can't just decide that we'll hear them whether they're there or not, because they have to be there for the hearings. And in terms of our decisions, we've decided all the measures that we had within the 10 days. So we do issue our decisions as soon as the hearings are done. And with most of them, it's mostly on the same day of the hearing. And in terms of the reasons for our decisions, you'll see that we had 20 that we were able to issue within the 20 the required period. The balance, we try and prioritize measures where there were like concerns, and we try and put them forward and try and have them out as soon as possible. And then the rest we also negotiate with the parties if we are not able to issue the reasons within the required period.
Okay, we can now deal with the other thing that we deal with, which I said are restrictive practices, and we're just going to mention a few of the more important cases we gave decisions of in this year. The first involved a case raised a question as to whether we had competition jurisdiction over a government department. A firm called AEC manufactures miners' safety lamps, for which you need a license from the Department of Mineral and Energy. And for reasons not clear to us, the Department of Mineral Energy had not issued these people with a license, and they therefore weren't able to enter the market and compete. And they'd alleged the Department of Mineral Energy was a monopoly and abusing its dominant position. And we said, look, this is not a competition issue, it's a administrative law issue if you have a complaint about whether the department is effectively using its licensing powers correctly. It's an administrative law issue and should go to the High Court and not come to the competition authorities. The next case was a case against South African Airways brought by two of its rivals, Comair and the erstwhile Nationwide. In fact, during the course of this case, Nationwide went into liquidation, and the case was continued by liquidators for Nationwide. And basically what they were asking for was a finding that there'd been a declaration that there'd been anti-competitive conduct by SAA, and their reason for doing so was to bring a civil claim for damages, because under our system, you first need to get a finding that there's been something wrongful done by the party from the competition tribunal, and then you have to proceed with that order to the High Court for an order for damages. So we determine whether there's been a wrongful act, whether there's been a contravention of the act, and then you go off to the High Court to determine the damages. So what Nationwide and Comair were doing was trying to attempt to get the order so they could bring a damages action. This case was a follow-up to an earlier decision of ours, and that's why I refer to it as SAA Part 2. It basically revolved around the remuneration by SAA of travel agents. The essential allegation was that SAA was paying travel agents remuneration in such a way that the more tickets they sold, the more they got paid as compensation, but not incrementally, in other words, by increase in volume, but it sort of spiraled upwards. In fact, so that it became a huge incentive for them as they met higher targets to sell SAA in preference to other airlines. And we found, as in the previous case, as in the second case, that in a sense SAA was abusing its dominant position in the domestic airline industry to pay travel agents to incentivize them not to advise people to fly with other flights in preference to SAA, because they were almost being paid not to put you on other flights. And so, as in our earlier case, the finding was made against SAA of an abuse of dominance. In the previous case, we had fined SAA. In this case here, because it was simply a civil declaration and the Commission had settled earlier with SAA, there was no issue of whether we could issue a fine or not. It was simply a declaration as to whether they could then apply for damages. The matter is now on appeal by SAA. We'll have to see what happens with the appeal. But if the appeal is unsuccessful, then Comair and Nationwide will have to be able to bring a damages claim against SAA in the High Courts. Then our next slide here is a no fire despite the smoke. This is a case involving a fight between large cigarette companies. So it's a very different case from one that we've considered before. So a firm called JTI, Japanese Tobacco International, who are probably better known to you as the makers of Camel, brought a case against BAT, who are better known to you as the manufacturers of Peter Stuyvesant and Dunhill, and amongst others. And the allegation of JTI was that BAT was involved in a number of marketing practices, including how cigarettes get positioned on the shelf, in a way that was paying people who retailers not to show Camel and to favour to favour the products of Peter Stuyvesant and Dunhill. It was a very long case, and at the end of the day, we felt that there was nothing illegitimate. Although it was aggressive marketing, it wasn't an abuse of dominance. BAT has about 80% of the cigarette market. Camel has about 8%, but we believe that it wasn't illegal marketing. It may have been aggressive marketing, but it wasn't illegal, and we found against JTI the complainant. However, where we find there's a bona fide case, we will act very vigorously. Now, you will have heard from the Commission this morning and on previous occasions about the bread cartel. One of the cases, most of the companies involved in the bread cartel actually settled with the Commission through consent orders. Only one case actually went to trial, in which the bread company contested whether it was guilty, and then if we found it guilty, contested what would be an appropriate fine. And that bread company was Pioneer. And so we had to hear a case as to whether it was formed part of the bread cartel, and it related to two issues. One was specifically to allegations of a cartel in the Western Cape, and then allegations of a cartel in other provinces in the country. We found, after hearing against Pioneer, and we imposed the highest percentage fine. Let me distinguish, it wasn't the highest fine of all, because as we'll show you, there has been a higher fine, but we're allowed to fine up to 10% of a firm's turnover, and we fined Pioneer 9.5% of its bread turnover in the Western Cape and 10% of its national turnover to come to a total fine of 195 million. That decision, in between, I think the last time we were before this committee and now, had been taken on appeal by the Commission, interestingly enough, not by Pioneer. And then when the Commission took it on appeal, Pioneer did what's called a cross appeal and said, not the Commission's appeal, we want to say that we were wrongly convicted and the fine is too high. Set down for the appeal court, I think about a week ago, 10 days ago, and the party settled on, as people often do, on the stairs of the court, and so our decision will stand, and so the fine stands, neither party will take this further on appeal. And that is the last case in this well-known bread cartel, at the end of the bread cartel cases. If I can just look at some, while we're talking about fines, Loretta maybe just takes you through fines that we've imposed during this period.
Our highest fine imposed to date is the one against Sasol, which came to 250 million, and then there were three other firms that were fined, and they went into consent agreements with the commission, and these are the amounts that they agreed upon between themselves and the commission. Mali Pipes were fined 31 million, and Concrete Unit were fined 5.7 million, and Cobra were fined 4 million. So these are the amounts that they would have paid to the commission for the commission to pay over to the National Revenue Fund. Okay, if I could just move on to the turnaround times for restrictive practices. Four of the seven matters that we had were had within the 20 days of close of pleadings as required by the tribunal rules. And six of the eight matters that we decided on, we decided within 60 days of the last hearing. The two other matters that were not decided within that period would have been fairly complicated matters where we ran hearings of more than probably 2 days to probably about like 2 weeks, and there was a huge amount of evidence to consider, and that's why they were not able to decide them within the 60 days as required. And in terms of tribunal hearings, where we say the cases are taking more than a day to hear, you'd see if you compare 2008-2009 with this financial period, we had a lot of matters to consider in the previous period, and in this period we didn't have a lot of complicated matters to deal with. The measures. There are about 10 hearing days, and in the way this graph is that there were probably about three cases in measures that was had that we had for more than a day. So it probably will be the cases where we impose conditions as well. And in terms of prohibited practices, there were about three cases which were had in more than a day.
Right, moving on to a different theme, our activities outside of hearings. We like the Commission, participate in various international bodies. And so we are regularly attend meetings of the OECD, where South Africa is an observer member of the Competition Committee. And we also attend meetings of the International Competition Network, the ICN as it's known, who hold a number of training meetings throughout the year, and we send tribunal members and our case managers to these conferences. Moving on to just highlights of the year, I think important events from our point of view. Well, the first is in terms of who controls us, and that's why we are before you today. As you know, we moved to the Department of Economic Development from the 1st of April this year. So last year we were the last time before DTI. We also had our 10th year anniversary celebrations, and I think the Commission probably briefed you on that. We had a big conference in September of last year with international guests, and we brought out a publication which we circulated to the committee. So that was an important kind of period for us to reflect on what we'd done. And then unique to ourselves was the appointment from the beginning of August of 2009 of new tribunal members. Let me just explain a little bit about that. When you deal with a body like the tribunal, we propose the tribunal members, who are the people who sit on the panels and make the decisions. And we are not permanent appointees. We are appointed for periods of 5 years, and we are comprised of a mixture of full-time people. Three of us are full-time, myself, my colleague Yasmin Kering, and Andreas Hessels, and we've got seven other colleagues who are part-time, who we call upon to hear cases, and they're remunerated only when they do cases. Then we have a permanent staff of 14, and they provide services from the registry headed by Lerato Motuan's department, Janine de Klerk's corporate finance, and we have a case manager department, so those are the people who help us run the cases and do research for us. Now, the difference between that is that we, as an institution, appoint our staff and can determine their remuneration within certain boundaries, but the minister and the president appoint the tribunal members and determine their remuneration and how long they serve. So some of our tribunal members, as we'll see in the next slide, if I can just show you there, you'll see that some names are in brown. Those are the people who finished in July 2009, and the names in black were people who were tribunal members who continue beyond 2009, either because, like myself and Yasmin Karim, they've been given new terms, or because their terms overlap with that period. Some people overlap with that. But the one significant name there, David Lewis, our first chairperson, has served two terms as chair and retired after that. So we feel he's lost. He's made a huge contribution to our system, and you'll see that we acknowledge him in a number of places on our annual report. And also our deputy chair, Maruma Marani, also no longer able to has retired from the tribunal after 2 periods. Then we appointed some new members, seven new appointments were made. Some overlapped with people who were already there, but the three names there in brown are people, in the brown type, are people who are first-time members of the tribunal. So in a sense, if you look at the mix of those people, seven people have previous experience on the tribunal, three are new, and I think we think it's a good mix between experience and bringing in new blood to the institution. As far as our staff is concerned, in other words, those are the people who are employed permanently, we've got a complement of 14 people in our three divisions, and those are the three divisions and the people who head those divisions. The next slide shows you our staff's breakdown on race and gender. That's the staff of 14, and this is how it breaks down on those particular categories amongst the 14 people. And then separately, we've done you a slide on tribunal members and how they break down on those particular categories, and that is out of, at the moment, 10 people. We have one vacancy amongst tribunal members. The president can appoint up to 11 people. We have 10 at the moment. We haven't yet felt the need to fill that vacancy because of the level of hearings. And one might say, well, why not just fill it? The reason is you want to keep people who are there busy enough so they keep their hand in it. But I suppose, like playing golf, you've got to keep going around the course pretty often to keep your swing in. So the same is with people. If they have too few cases, then they don't have enough experience amongst our part-time members. Going back to our staff itself, we thought we'd just give a slide of the experience within the staff. You'll see that just over 30, about 35% of people have been with us more than 10 years. In other words, we're only 11 years old as an institution. Some of them, my two colleagues on my other side of me, have been there right from the beginning. And there's a considerable percentage who've been there less than 5 years. I think it is significant that amongst our management staff, the three divisional managers have all been there for 10 years. The newer people tend to be amongst our case manager staff. They tend to be there only for a small period of time because they're a bit like candidate attorneys in a law firm. We train people up in the institution and they then go on to, because they become eligible for more senior jobs, a number of them have gone on to, for instance, the Competition Commission, or they go to the private sector. So we expect a turnover amongst our junior staff, certainly amongst our candidate attorneys, and that probably explains that breakdown there. The financial management, Janine, will now deal with that.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take you through some of the highlights of the financial aspects of the annual report, and I'll begin with explaining that we underspent our budget by 30.11%, which was primarily related to three major underspending areas, and one was on the training of tribunal members. We took a conscious decision not to send some of our new tribunal members overseas this year because they were new and we felt they needed to be exposed at a local level to the workings of the tribunal before sending them overseas, so that reduced our budget. And in addition, I think the last time we were here, we spoke to you about the development of the case document management software, and we had budgeted to spend that last year, but the process was delayed by the fact that we had to go out on tender because the original quotes we had got exceeded the tender limits, so that was delayed. And then, as Lerato indicated earlier, we had a substantial decrease in the number of hearing days, which impacts on our budget because we pay the part-time members for attending those hearings. And in the next slide, you will see the extent to which these hearing days decreased. And in 2009, we had 123 and a half hearing days, whereas in 2010, we had 75 hearing days. And in terms of person days for the part-time members who are paid an additional amount to it or paid to attend those hearings, it went from 126.5 person days to 52 person days. So it was a substantial decrease and therefore underspending on that line item. In terms of our financial performance, I think we have a fairly high level of financial control. We have a number of financial and accounting policies in place that are also currently being updated and will be reviewed by the Audit Committee over the next few weeks. We have no substantial balance sheet issues that need to be brought to this meeting's attention, and our financial statements are prepared on the accrual basis. In terms of financial performance, we've had a functioning audit committee since inception, and it meets at least four times a year and sometimes more. We received an unqualified report this year. We had no financial misconduct findings and we had no significant findings apart from, I think, one which is common throughout public entities, and that is around measurable targets, the area that the Auditor General has said he's going to be focusing on in the future in terms of audit. Then in terms of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which we are required to report on, we had a small amount which SARS said we owed them for PAYE, which we had in fact paid, but it was paid in a later period and SARS hadn't picked it up, so we decided rather to settle the amount with SARS and then query it, and we're still waiting for some answers from SARS, but that was just over 3,000 Rand. In terms of this report, we were also obliged by the Auditor General to report on any expenditure that we had incurred in lieu of the Soccer World Cup, and our expenditure was 13,000, which was spent on 30 soccer t-shirts for our staff and security personnel, and that was a decision that we made instead of using t-shirts which we normally bought for our corporate image. We bought these soccer t-shirts, and they, as you'll see in our annual report, they were used in our photographs as well, and it contributed to the general support of Bafana during the World Cup. And then we spent a smaller amount of 219 Rand on flags for the office. In terms of funding, as indicated in this table, you will see that Since 2009, we've had an increased dependency on the government grant to cover our income, and this is partly due to the fact that the thresholds, as I think indicated in the previous presentation to this committee, the threshold levels changed, and that meant that we were now getting slightly less in terms of filing fees via the commission. And then also, because of the decrease in the merger activity during the previous financial year, we found filing fees were reduced. So the government granted a significantly higher percentage of income than it was in the past. In terms of financial management, you'll see that 54.7% of our budget is spent on personnel, and the other funding is spent across administration, training, professional services, and operating expenses. And there's been some changes, some increases and some decreases around those. I think the one before which this committee was interested in was the breakdown of professional services. So I've shown you in the next slide how we define professional services, and we are going to be changing this definition going forward in our new budget. But it's made up of consulting, and that is for any outside consultants we use for either policy development, or in this case we used an IT specialist to assist us with drawing up the specifications for the IT tender. Recruitment, which is small fees paid either to a recruitment agency or to place adverts in the newspaper for vacant positions. Public relations, which is a fee paid to a consultant who attends to our media relations. Then the part-time members' fees, and you'll see that decreased substantially by 40.28%. And again, I gave those reasons earlier, primarily related to the decrease in hearing days. Then recording fees, again, that decreased because the recording fees depends on the number of hearing days, and because our hearing days were reduced, we had less that we had to pay for the transcription services. And then the facility fees is the fee that is paid to the Competition Commission because we share premises and share some services. It's cost effective for us to share in their security, share in their knowledge center resources, as opposed to setting up our own library or having our own security service. Then in terms of financial challenges going forward, I think for us, the one that we will be focusing on is continuous funding from the department. We have got sufficient funding in the form of accumulated surpluses to last over this current NTF period, but the 3 years following, we would be looking for more money from the EVD. Then the other one is to develop smart targets. As indicated in the audit report by the Auditor General, there was a finding related to the fact that our targets were not smart, and we are currently doing some work with our internal auditors around developing more measurable objectives and ones around which we can set more smart targets. And then another requirement is aligning our budget to targets. So while we can't align our budget entirely, we're trying to align as much of our budget as we can to the targets that we set. And I think before Norman goes on, I think the one general challenge for us is the implementation of the case management system, which has started now. We've begun with the people who we contracted with for the tender, and they're beginning to do the work, and we will be having significant focus on the year going forward and ensuring that system does what we wanted to do, both in terms of managing the documents and managing the cases, and at the same time providing us with some of the information we need with regard to targets and performance information.
So I can just deal with the remaining general challenges if I can work sort of upwards. The widening of the intern program, we mentioned previously when we dealt with the strat plan before this committee that we have university interns who come to us twice a year, who are law graduates, and we are wanting to widen that program to include people who are not necessarily law graduates, but just to work in our administration for holiday periods. It's obviously going to be a very modest program. We're a small institution, but we want to sort of provide more opportunities there. Improving access to justice. Just last week, we had a meeting with a number of lawyers and an NGO called Pro Bono. And what we're trying to do is to make sure that everybody who wants to bring a competition case can have legal and economic expert representation in the case. and together with this organization called Pro Bono, which is an organization which matches clients with lawyers who will act for them pro bono, which is a polite Latin way of saying I'll act for you for nothing. We got a very good take up. 100 lawyers came to and economists came to this meeting. We were very enthusiastic about that. In fact, our problem is not so much to get people to do something, but to get enough people who are interested in the take up of the program. But we hope that that improves people's ability, particularly small business, to bring cases if they think they're meritorious, but also to advise people who perhaps don't have a competition case, maybe it's a commercial dispute, that they're wasting their time or money bringing this case, and they will hear that from a neutral professional party. Finally, I think the most important challenge for us is expediting case resolutions. Competition cases take too long, and I think the committee has noted that before, and we're aware of that problem, as is our ministry. And there are various ideas being mooted as to how to deal with this. It's not as if there is a single person to blame. You know, it's not as if it is the lawyers or the companies or the commission or the courts or the tribunal. I think we all in some way are partly to blame for the way the system, why the system takes up and takes so long. And so we're looking at various ideas, which each one is going to be small in itself, which might expedite the cases. One initiative which looks at the moment quite important is the problem of too many appeals, which I think I've mentioned before. At the moment, the case gets brought by the commission to the tribunal. Tribunal hears the case, and you can appeal that decision to the Competition Appeal Court. You can appeal that decision to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and if it raises a constitutional issue, you can go to the Constitutional Court. That can all take a terribly long period of time. It's happening in a case involving the milk industry at this very moment. It means the cases take years before they even start. So one idea has been to move whether, given that the Constitutional Court will now have a wider remit under the Superior Courts Bill, in other words, deal with non-constitutional issues as well, is it necessary still for the Supreme Court of Appeal to be an added layer above the Constitution Appeal Court? And it seems the idea has taken off and gained acceptance that it may be possible to cut out that rung of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and that if you want to, you can appeal from the Competition Appeal Court to the Constitutional Court. So there would still be two appeals, but at least it's not three appeals, because at the moment, the Supreme Court of Appeal leg takes at the very quickest 12 months and sometimes 18 months onto this period. Other ideas within our own institution are being mooted, and we want to look at bringing out guidelines in the course of early next year, just to practitioners to try and reduce our own time periods, and also to look at our own disciplines in terms of us writing our decisions more quickly. The Commission itself will also be looking about what it can do to speed up the system. But that, at the moment, I think, is the biggest challenge that the institutions face, and we've got to try and expedite them. As I've said before, it is not a problem unique to South Africa. Competition law cases are very fact-heavy and involve intensive investigation. If you were to look at our counterparts, they are not much quicker. They are not quicker than we are, and sometimes even slower. And so it's symptomatic of the nature of the competition system, the nature generally of the legal system, that these cases take too long. But that doesn't mean we should be complacent about them. Just accept that it should be so, because it's so in other places, and see what we can try and do to expedite cases. And at least from the tribunal's point of view, that's probably the most important challenge that we need to face, not only I think in the coming year, but in years to come, as we try to reform it and see what we can do. And thank you. That's our presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manon. To the two supportive ladies. Lerato and Janine, thank you very much for the presentation. It is quite a clear presentation, and thank you really for making it this easy. And it is, I'm looking at the report, it's quite professional and it's quite detailed. Thank you very much for that, and I wish you could keep up the good work. You said the same thing to the Competition Commission. I think the work that you're doing is quite commendable. it can be reported to in this professional manner. Thank you. Colleagues, here's the report. It needs to be entertained. Can we entertain it? Mr. Marain Sentuli, Dr. Ravi, Dr.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I've shared my compliments with your report. It's very easy to read and it's very professional. I want to compliment you on the price that you paid for that soccer t-shirt as well. It was quite substantially lower than the shelf price, so I don't know whether there's something in there. See whether it's, you know, you bought it from maybe someone that that appeared in one of your cases.
Maybe so hit the brand.
Tongue in the cheek, but it's a very good price. So that's very good.
Okay.
Just on the
all right.
Just a very small thing. Another one. You've reported on your staff composition and your gender and race. I'm very interested in whether you have employed any people with disabilities, because I believe that you've got the same probable objectives or targets that you've got of 2% of your staff. So whether you've done anything in that regard, or if you haven't, you know, what can we expect in the future? Next time around, can we ask you whether you have achieved your 2% or where you've exceeded that? Then lastly, just on that, on the Pioneer case, I'm quite interested in what's the grounds or the merits for the commission to lodge the appeal or to start the appeal. It's just really interesting. And what is their grounds for that? Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Chair Justin. And I'd like to also to concur with the chairperson and my colleague, Mr. Murray, about the presentation. Chairperson, I'm not sure whether I heard correctly when the commissioner was saying that some of the members do get promotion to the competition commission. If it's I was thinking that the commission takes all their cases, all those to the tribunal. But now if you say they are promoted to maybe money-wise, or if you can be able to elaborate on that one. And you spoke about surpluses. Is it because of less work, or how do you get surplus? Because we had this thing last time that the department were not spending and they call it surpluses instead of underspending. Then you spoke about the smart tactics. What do you mean by smart tactics? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Antony. Dr. Ravi?
Thank you, Chair. First and foremost, I think it's an excellent. Thank you, Madam. First and foremost, I think I'd like to agree with some of the other members of the committee. I think it's an excellent report. But, Madam, I'd just like to get further clarity on fruitless and wasteful expenditure, I think, on page 78 there. Is it possible to the figure 3 is mentioned there, 3 and 1? I'd just like to, if it's possible, get clarity on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dr. Huang.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's just Chairperson and the other member are just proud for this professional report. But some of the figures are still doubt. From your presentation, this I think financial management. Can you come back to your slide? Come back to this other one, yes. So from your last block is there's a percentage for charge, for change. This one, I from the your calculator, I don't know how you can calculate this 14.04% from this one. If you from the this one, the 6.11 the plus 4.41, then minus 7.82 minus 10.8, how you can come into the 14? How can come into 14.04? Because if from the other two plus at least 2009, 2010 is 100% coming. I can't see this percentage. 14.04% is right. Because I think everyone just thinking you have the provisional report. I want to see this one, how you can get it. If you from this broker, we can calculate it. Because if it is 58.14 is right, then this one total must be 50.76 here. I don't know how you can come in 14.04.
Yes.
And the second, this one you can keep, yeah, you can go calculate it, then after you can reply. Then the next slide. Can you come to the next one? No, other one. This one, a distribution for the provisional one, yeah? Also, this is a percentage change. I also can find that it's a 10.8, minus 10.08 is right. If you from the 76.54, plus the minus 10, plus 25. I can't see this 10.08 is right. This one is, if from the this broker you calculated, must be minus 25.44. So I don't know, I haven't got calculated, but I can calculate by my hand, that is already this one, I found that this is wrong. So I hope you can adjust this one, which one is right one. Then if this report is a professional, I think that is the annual report, it must be more 100% professional. So if you find the page 24, we can see that is same, there is the same this table, yeah? This is 10.4, your report from the your slide is 14.04. Then here is a 4.01. Same amount. All the same table, same amount. But your percentage is all the quite big difference. Your presentation is a 14.04. But your annual report, this book will become to the parliament. It's only 4.01. And the inside is 6.11, 4.41. Mm-hmm. Then this one, your presentation is minus 7.82, but here is the plus, 7.82. You didn't get the minus. So I think that from that is the confusion to us. Yeah, two different documents, two different figures, and also different calculators. So I hope this one. Yeah. Then you come to next page 25. Page 25 also same as this consultant, this one. This percentage is 10.08%, like the your figure, but this figure is wrong. So I don't know which one is right for you can show to the committee which one is right. Otherwise we can't approve for this annual report. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Wang. I think he's. I must follow up on that one. There's no way that you can have 100% distribution and have the variance. That is not a 0%. I don't know how is that explained also. It's a challenge that perhaps you need to be educated on. I just want to understand also the in terms of Nedbank and Imperial Bank, and also I think you said Pamuzi and Harmony, there were job losses. Were you able able to perhaps link, I understand there were conditionalities, but also I feel it was going to be important that you also talk to other stakeholders as part of, or refer to other stakeholders as part of a solution or measures to be implemented by the mentioned companies, so that we save, even or we use measures in place by other within the country to resolve certain challenges like job losses kind of challenges. I just want to find out if in the first place you do cooperate and collaborate with other stakeholders in such a way that you can be able to refer before you take a decision on a particular matter, especially a matter that has a negative impact in the economy of the country, because your role is to ensure that economic activity prevails in the country. I do understand what I'm saying is not neglecting the fact that you did put conditions, especially around how certain things need to be done. The other question that I had is around the financial performance on your slide 38. You have an internal audit committee, but you're not reporting about an internal audit unit. Because if your internal audit committee meets only four times a year, is the financial person responsible to day-to-day risk assessment issues or management issues also? And who then informs the audit committee? What informs the audit committee on, you know, in during their meetings? What are they meeting about? Those are the questions. I just want to also congratulate you. I don't know whether other years, other than the current year under review, is the only year, this one, that you got unqualified. How has been your performance for the past 5 years? Perhaps if you can, just for interest sake, just to get that information. And the fact that Competition Commission was told that 23% of their targets were not smart. You are told that 24% of your targets are not smart. What could attribute to such a finding or conclusion by the auditor general? Because it might be something that perhaps affects both of you, that is not of your own making. Perhaps if you can just tell us your thinking around this. Because I can see that in terms of your challenges, you are mentioning that you have to do something about the SMART target, which means you do understand the statement made by the auditor general. The question around the payers and shortfall of 3,000, which I think the auditor general described as a fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Can you perhaps clarify that so that we are able to understand? It is a shortfall. How did it come about that you have such a shortfall? And why is it defined as a fruitless and wasteful expenditure, whereas it's a shortfall? because here you are saying it's a shortfall, pay-as-you-earn shortfall. The Auditor General says it's a fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Okay. Just on a lighter note, are these flags still flying?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. May I hand over to you, Mr. Manu?
If I can sort of just divide the questions between, I think Mr. Clerk will respond to the financial questions, and I'll deal with the others. So we'll come back to those. I think the first question was a policy on staff with disabilities. We don't have a policy on the issue at all, and at the moment we haven't got anybody employed who has disabilities. But we note the point, and I think it's something we must look at. But at the moment we don't have a person with disabilities, and we haven't set a target around that. But we take the point. This is something we should address. On the point on the Pioneer appeal, what were the Commission's reasons for appealing our decisions? Is 195 billion rand not enough? I think the difference between the Commission's attitude and our own is that the Act says that you can fine a firm up to 10% of its annual turnover in a particular year. We had fined it up to 9.5% of its affected turnover, in other words, turnover in bread. This is a company that not only makes bread, but makes many other products. It makes orange juice, it makes flour, etc., etc. And the Commission felt that we should have, given the seriousness of this of the nature, included all the turnover, including the non-affected turnover. Our view was that might be very circumstantial. Some companies may be involved in exactly the same thing, have the same turnover in bread, but because one is structured in terms of divisions in other products and not subsidiaries, it would land up paying a much higher fine than the others because we looked at total turnover. So that was really the difference between an attitude between total turnover and affected turnover. We felt that if you take total turnover, unless there's a rational connection between the total turnover and the turnover where the offence has occurred, one would be overreaching and fining a firm too much. In terms of the question about were tribunal members being promoted to the Competition Commission, I may have been given an incorrect impression that it's not the tribunal members themselves, it's staff of the tribunal, particularly at a junior level. We have people who are known as case managers. They are young law graduates or economics graduates. And what will happen is that they'll work for us for a period of 2 years, and a more senior position will be on offer, say, in the Commission's legal department, and they'll take up the position there. It's not tribunal members themselves who've gone to the Commission. And one of the problems for the tribunal, just as an employer, is that because we've got a very small staff, we don't have too many positions for people who want to, you know, get more experience and become more senior. Those positions are, we've only got three managers, for instance, in our institution, so people go to the Commission. We and the Commission see that as a good thing. And similarly, they have an internship program, and a lot of the interns land up working as our case managers. So there's a cross-pollination, which I think is good for both institutions. As far as the Chair, you asked about the job losses in mergers and whether we talk to other stakeholders. I think in all the cases that have been that we've been referred to, we have the trade unions have actually been very actively involved in these particular cases and negotiating the conditions. And we see as part of our function is to make sure that unions are in fact strengthened and involved in these situations. And particularly in the case of Pomodzi, the union in fact came along to support that condition that had been imposed and came with the company. People had actually travelled from, I think it was from Belcom, to say, look, please make this condition, improve the merger urgently. And in that particular case, that mine would have failed. In fact, it would probably have closed down. All the jobs would have gone. So it was a case, although some jobs were lost, it was whether all are then lost. So stakeholders like trade unions and, where necessary, civic associations are able to engage in our proceedings, and we encourage them to come forward if they want to do so. I think one of the related issues to that, Chair, and I think perhaps gets to your question, is this information then looked at by the stakeholders like our department as to what we can do with it. And I think one of the intentions of our Minister of Economic Development is to ensure that there is more coordination between these institutions, so we're not all in our silos. So if, for instance, there is underinvestment in a particular sector or job losses, then our sister bodies like the IDC, who are extending finance, are involved in that. And I think one of our challenges going forward is to communicate more with those stakeholders. We're seeing this happen. We've got an interesting record that says this has happened in this particular industry. Could other institutions within the same family intervene in a particular way? And I think we are, looking at ways of trying to do that more. But insofar as direct stakeholders are concerned, unions and if they want to, community organisations do get involved in some of these issues. I think the rest are financial questions of Janine.
Okay, first of all, my apologies. There was a gremlin in that one, the first table that Mr. Wong referred to, and that is the financial management one. It shouldn't be 14.04. It's correct as per in the financial statements, 4.01, and then it's an increase of 7.8%. If I can just explain how these percentages work. The percentages are, if you look at our... on page 56, if you look at the figures given over the 2 years, the total expenditure in 2010 was 18.301, and then the 10.009 as a percentage of that 18.301 is the 54.7. So the first column tells you how our expenditure was distributed across those four major categories of expenditure that we define. And then the percentage change reflects that figure of, in 2009, personnel was 9.433, and in 2010, it was 10.009. So personnel expenses had increased by 6.11%. And then that 4.01 would refer to the fact that the total expenditure has increased from 7.593 to 18.301. So that's how that particular table works. Then the other one, the professional services one, that figure is correct. And if you look at note 12 on page 70, it says under other operating expenses, consultants, contractors, and special services. Now that is the professional services figure, and that went down from 3.341 to 3.004 between those two periods that we were reporting on, and that's the minus 10.08% decrease. And then that figure of 3 million, or just over 3 million, is broken down into consulting, recruitment, public relations, part-time tribunal members, fees, recording costs, and facility fees. In here, I've just given you the percentage, but if you wanted to see the actual figures, I can send that through to Swazi as a separate attachment. But what it will say is similar to the other one, that professional fees, the total of 3 million, the distribution is across these different categories, but then consulting in the 1 year increased by 76.5% or decreased, depending on which particular line item you're looking at. But I can give you those actual figures because they're not in this report, because we don't have to go into that detail there. Then the other question related to the targets, if I remember correctly, SMART stands for specific, measurable, accurate, reliable, and time-bound. And there's been the increased focus by the Auditor General and National Treasury on institutions setting targets that meet that SMART criteria. And the problem with the Tribunal and the Commission is that and particularly the Tribunal, is that we are a regulatory body and we can't predetermine targets. We react to the cases that are brought before us. And so while in the past we've reported on the number of cases we've had and we've said our turnaround times are, as Lerata presented in some of those slides, 52 of the decisions were issued within 10 days. In terms of the audit that they conduct, those don't meet the SMART criteria. So they're wanting us to investigate that more fully. And instead of reporting on everything, to find certain objectives that we can set SMART targets around and then report on those. So that's the exercise that we're doing with the internal auditors now and external audits, and hopefully with Treasury as well, where we're looking at what of our targets can we set and then separate them out and report on the numbers as such separately from the performance information. So we're looking at perhaps setting based on trend, setting t- targets around, we're going to set down, let's say, 50% of our hearings within 10 days and then report, did we set down 50% of our hearings within 10 days, and if we didn't, why not? So that's the exercise that we're conducting there. There's some that you can specifically set a target for, that, like we've done, training. So if you look at our performance information report, which is this detailed table, just need to find the pages. It starts at page 29. You'll see there where the targets are. For example, 3 per annum, that would almost fill the SMART criteria. But what they're wanting us to do now is to say in the first quarter you're going to have 1, in the second quarter you're going to have 2, or otherwise in the fourth quarter you're going to have all 3. So that's the exercise we're working with them. Then the unqualified report, we've never had a qualified report. So in the history of the tribunal, we haven't had a qualified report. And that's over the 10 years. Accumulated surpluses. I think the historic reason for accumulated surpluses in the tribunal is that we have earned these filing fees, which are a portion of the fees paid by firms lodging merger applications with the commission. And because in some years there's been large merger activity, and because in some years prior to the threshold adjustments there were large fees coming in, that's where our accumulated surpluses arose from. And so it's not so much to do with underspending, but more because we've generated our own income. And Treasury and the EDD have seen that what we've done with our accumulated surpluses over the next 3 years of the MTF, we're drawing down those accumulated surpluses to cover the shortfall on our budget over and above what the department has allocated as funding towards our expenses. Then the question around the audit committee, that reference in that slide is the external audit committee that consists of 5 outside non-executive members. And we have an internal audit function which is outsourced to KPMG. And they set an internal audit plan which they report to the audit committee on, both in terms of what they're planning to do and then the results of that audit. And the audit committee functions as the risk committee. So they are looking at the risk management within the tribunal and making sure that the internal audit plan addresses those risks and that we are dealing with any issues related to risk that may have been identified in the risk management. So when we have an audit committee meeting, we start with the risk management meeting and we discuss the risk register, the risk report, the controls, any problems there. We close off that meeting and then we start with the audit committee, and then they carry on with their internal external audit report.
So is this in the audit unit?
Because
even though you've outsourced it, are you part of the KPMG?
I'm not part of KPMG, but I'm the person that they would be liaising with in the tribunal with regard to the audit. But there will be areas, like for example in Lerato's area, that need to be audited, and in the case management area. So they draw up their internal audit plan based on the risk register and what they perceive and we perceive to be the highest risks. And then, of course, there's certain areas that they have to audit, like financial management, and then IT is another area that they have to audit. So that will form part of the internal audit plan, which is discussed with the audit committee, and all the reports from the internal audits with management's response are presented to the audit committee and discussed at each audit committee meeting. The internal audit may do more than, and generally does more than, 4 internal audits during a year in different focus areas.
Okay, and then I'm checking here the cost implication of having KPMG or having outsourced the internal audit functions vis-a-vis having your own internal audit unit.
I can't categorically state, but I would imagine that at the moment it's cheaper for us to outsource it to KPMG because it costs us less than $600,000 a year. And if you have an internal audit unit, we would have to have more than one person. It would have to be somebody separate from me, because otherwise there would be control issues and segregation of duties. And you probably would need to have at least 2 people. And the salaries of 2 people in an internal audit would exceed that outsourced cost. And I think it also adds some measure of independence that you don't get if you have, that you may not get if your internal auditor's in the department as well.
Fair enough. I think the cost, because I was concerned about the cost. But if you say it costs less than 600,000 a year, then it makes sense.
Yeah.
But why didn't you declare it here, or is there somewhere where?
No, it is here. Let me just find where.
Or it is in the.
Yes, it's in the notes. And it's under external audit fees, internal audit fees on page 69. And then somewhere in our governance section, we will report that the audit has been done. Internal audits on page 20 says what internal audits they've done. So you'll see there it cost, last year it cost 412 for the internal audit. This year it's slightly more. And I mean, surprisingly enough, for us now, what we're finding is that our external audit is costing us more than our internal audit, and we are audited by the Auditor General.
Mm.
My apologies for the gremlins in that table.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to find, there's one question didn't answer. Why, in terms of percentages, you have 100%? And the variance is above 1%.
Let me just find those ones again if we were looking at the tables. Sorry. You see, that 100% is if you look at on page 56, where the total expenditure is 18 million. That 18 million is the 100%, and the 10 million, which is personnel, is
100% of what?
The expenditure makes up 100%. So if you add the 54.7, 17.82, 7.7, 16.42, 3.36, that will give you your 100%. So if you're looking at our expenditure of 18 million, how is it spent? 54.7% is spent on personnel, and 3.36 is spent on operating expenses. So in the 1 year, that was our distribution. And the next year, the previous year, our personnel only accounted for 53.62% of total expenditure, and professional services 18.8%.
I'm looking for the marriage between your variance and your actual.
Okay, the variance, it's not looking at the change in the percentages, it's looking at from 9.433 in personnel in 2009 to 10.009 personnel in 2010 was a 6.11% increase.
Oh, that's
a
year on year.
Yeah, so personnel increased by 6.11%, and then overall the expenditure increased by 4.01%.
Okay, thank you.
And it would be the same for that other table that Mr. Wong raised a question about.
It would be the same.
Can I suggest that in the future maybe you must give it to us in actual figures
and index figures.
Yeah. I think that will be much easier to
understand. It's summarized in the annual report, but I can, as I say, I'll provide you with the actual figures for the professional services so you can see.
Or you just put year on year variance so that we see the year on year change instead of, you know, what we think is the difference between this and that. Yeah.
You know, one of the new accounting standards is that we're supposed to be reporting against budget, but this year they didn't implement it fully. So on page 80, you'll see how we get the reconciliation between budget and the statement of financial performance. And there it gives you some detail as to where we underspent or overspent, if we overspent on various line items. And then, sorry, there was the question around the PAYE shortfall. Now, what happened with that is that SARS, when they do their recon, come back to us and say you've got a shortfall of 3,000 Rand. But in actual fact, it's not a shortfall, because what happened is that that money has been paid. But because it was in 1 month, there was a 2,900, I can't remember the exact figures. Let's say at the end of February, 2,900 was due and we paid it in March. because of the delay in which the tribunal members' fees were paid, because people are part-time and they're not initially all on the payroll. They then said it was a shortfall. But we had paid them already. But they seem to have a problem with their system where they don't initially reflect that there was a shortfall supposedly in that month, but it was paid in the next month. So they're just saying to us that we didn't pay it. And we've queried that with them, but we're waiting for a response. And we've actually paid it. There was never any shortfall, but we paid any penalties or fines associated with that shortfall just so that they didn't accrue, because what happens with SARS is that it sits in their books, and as you don't pay it, accrues more and more interest. So we decided rather to pay it while we queried the amount, as opposed to just letting it accrue more money.
But just on that, is it AG that says they query and they are conducting their own investigation into this matter? You're saying SARS says it's the money that
no, we are.
You're saying you paid the money over to SARS.
Yeah.
And SARS is saying that you have a shortfall for March.
Yeah, but we did pay it. As it says here, we paid the amount in April 2007, and we're therefore disputing the liability. And we have gone into SARS and said, please look into this matter. You say there was a shortfall, but we paid it in April 2007, and your records don't reflect that we paid it.
So you are disputing that?
Yes, yeah. But it has to be reflected as fruitless and wasteful expenditure because
you paid over the
amount. Yeah, because they're saying we owe it. We'd rather settle it, pay it, than have a bill accruing and then just getting larger and larger.
So the auditors have not settled it. They are still investigating.
No. The auditors don't investigate it. They've noted it. They agree with us that it should be correctly reflected as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And if we come back and say, sorry, we made a mistake, we see you did pay it, then they clear it, then next year we'll say that amount that was declared as fruitless and wasteful expenditure has been reversed.
I'm reading the statement sort of for this dialogue, but I just want to be clear. If you read the last but one sentence, the tribunal has paid this amount over to SARS while we query and conduct our own investigation into this matter.
Yeah.
Who is we?
The tribunal. So we've written to SARS to ask them, why do you say there's a liability? We don't say there's a liability. We paid the amount. Would you please explain? And then when they come back, we'll clear it.
Doesn't sound like it's you. It sounds like it's somebody else.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you understand what I mean. The tribunal has paid this amount over to SARS while we query and conduct our own investigation into this matter.
Not much from the audit committee.
Yeah, it could have read while the tribunal and while the tribunal queries and conducts its own investigation into this matter.
All right. This is your.
Sorry, it is my report, so it's me speaking.
It's you speaking.
Yes, that's why.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Wang, you wanted to...
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it's the financial manager is still not adjusted for the what you would correct now. Can you come back to the your slides? So this is 14.04. Yeah? This 14.04, if from your adjustment, I just wanted to... You can show to the committee how you can come into the 14.04 from this table.
She says it's not correct.
Yeah. But why you don't from your computer can correct? I want to know what is correct.
Corrected one is the version in the report.
But in the report inside, this one also not correct.
It is sorry.
This is page 24 also not right, because the page 24 only 4.01. Yes, 4.01 is
yes.
A, C say is a is correct one is a 14.04.
4.01
is a correct one.
Yes. In the annual report, it's correct.
Yeah. If you say the annual report is correct.
Yes.
I don't know. This is a 4.01. came from here, how you can calculate the corporate overhead?
No, but you can't calculate it from there. You have to calculate from the actual.
No, no, you, this report you can't make it like this. We must see the other one. You didn't indicate. Because your table is show to the 100%. Then now you come to the 4.01.
Yeah, but she has explained that.
No, but you can't explain to everybody.
It says I'm totally
explained. Can I tell the chairperson?
Assess, sorry.
Okay. I can see that.
So
that they've taken over, Dr. Ma?
I not finished yet, sorry. It's complicated.
Can you pose your question?
My question is the other minus 10.08, you still know indicator for which calculator you can come to the minus 10.08 for this table. Because it's from your amount inside. I don't know how you can calculate this one. I want to see this one, 76.54. You must deduct that all that is minus, then come to 10.08.
Yeah, but that's not
the case. So this table, you can make it like this, show to the committee. How you can get this 100%?
You have to.
Yes, 100% is all right. We agree.
Yeah.
But the other minus 10, where come from minus 10?
From the actual figure.
No. Can we allow the presenters to report?
Yes, please. Yeah, this one.
Sorry, if you look at page 24 above that table that Dr. Wong was referring to, it says total expenditure net of capital expenditure for the period increased by 4.01% from 17.59 to 18.3. Now that 4.01 and the total expenditure there is not an addition of the percentage change. Its total expenditure for the year increased by 4.01% from 17.59 to 18.3. If you go back and look at my financial statements and you see the individual figures given for personnel, for administration, for training, for professional services, and other operating expenses, then that last column reflects the changes in each of those line items. It's not the changes in the percentage. It's how much did administration increase from 2009 to 2010, or how much did it decrease? So that's the explanation for the last column. In terms of the professional services one, where you've got the change of minus 10.08, what I've said is I'll give you the actual figures for this, but the professional services is distributed by these categories: consulting, recruitment, public relations, part-time tribunal members, recording costs, facility fees. The total expenditure on professional fees is 100%, and it's distributed as follows. But if you look at the increase in the figures from 2009 to 2010, you will see that consulting increased by 76.54. Those are the figures that I said I will give to you in a separate chart, because unfortunately the level at which we have to present these for the annual report doesn't give you those exact details. So I'll give you those figures so you can see how I'm arriving at those changes. But the minus 10.08% refers to the change on page 70. In 2009, we spent 3.341 on consultants, contractors, and special services. This year, we spent 3.004. So that change is the minus 10.08%. But the detail of that you can't see in this diagram, and I will provide that separately to you via Swazi so you can see the actual rand amounts that arrived at it. But as I say, that...
So 4.01 is right?
Yes.
So 14 is wrong?
Yes.
Okay.
I apologize for that gremlin that came in the one on there, but in the annual report, the figures are correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. The chairperson has requested that I continue chairing this meeting. Do we still have any follow-up questions to the commission, to the tribunal? Do you have any? If I think we have exhausted our questions, so I will turn it over to the chairperson for their comments. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. let's take this opportunity, Rick, to thank you very much for the report and for the responses given. I think we are quite happy with the way we have discussed and debated some of the issues. May you continue with your good work, and all the best. We're just hoping that you can cooperate your work with the other, you know, stakeholders, so that we achieve what we're really intending to as a country. Thank you very much, and all the best. Members, thank you also. Your words before I close.
Chair, on our behalf, may we thank you and the committee as well for your questions and your interest and both your compliments to us and constructive suggestions which we will take up and deal with next time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I will organize very much
Okay, you're imposing your club to them. Okay. The meeting for this session is adjourned, but members remain for the continuation.